We are going to be looking at Esther chapter 2. We're continuing our series, Esther, for such a time as this. And we're going to be looking at this story in the Old Testament over the next, well, now 9 weeks, about how God had placed Esther in the kingdom for such a time as this, for just the right moment for God to show up and do something special. And, you know, we live in the same times. God has placed us for such a time as this. And what is it that we are called to do in this hour? And so as we compare the story of Esther to the story of Christ in the New Testament, we get a picture of what Jesus is all about. The New Testament is clear, and the Old Testament is hinting that all of these stories, all of this activity that happens in the Old Testament is often not just historical fact, but it is also a prophetic foreshadowing to something else that's going to happen. For example, if you think about the person of Jonah, a man who rebelled against God's call in his life to go to Nineveh and to preach the kingdom of heaven, he instead runs away in the opposite direction on a merchant's ship, and he enters into a storm, and superstitious people on board the ship say, someone here has done something against the gods, and that's why this storm is so relentless. And Jonah confesses that he's running from Yahweh, and so they throw him overboard to save the ship. And Jonah descends into the water of baptism and is buried for 3 days in the belly of a fish, for 3 days and three nights, until he is brought back and spit out on the shores of Nineveh and preaches the kingdom of heaven. And what happens when Jonah preaches? The people repent and turn from their sin and turn to God. It's a great historical account of an event that happened in God's history, but it also is a foreshadowing of Christ, who, unlike Jonah, was not rebelling, but he was living life for God on this earth, and he was buried in the tomb for 3 days and three nights. And he rose again, preaching the kingdom of heaven. And the people repented and turned from their sin and back to God. And so the story of Jonah is not just a historical account, but it is a picture or a monument that casts a shadow of what Jesus would be and would become. And the story of Esther is not unlike the story of Job and many of the other Old Testament accounts. And as I was looking at this and studying the book of Esther, and I encourage you, it's not a long book. You could probably sit down tonight and read it beginning to end, just all 10 chapters. The last chapter is only, what, 3 verses? Yeah. So just as an example, and some of the others are also pretty brief. But you can read this in one setting and just kind of get your mind around the story. And as you read it, you may discover what Hollywood has discovered. This is a great story. It has a wonderful plot. The characters are dynamic and change. Some of them are static and unchangeable, stubborn people. Anybody know somebody like that? And meanwhile, all of this story unfolds with this climactic ending as the villain and the good guys face off in this story. And Hollywood has made accounts of this story. There's one called, a recent one called One Night with a King. There's another one called Esther, simply titled. And they picked up on this story. And as I was thinking about this epic story that is the story of Esther, it reminded me of some of the Arabian Nights stories that we've probably heard. Are you familiar with the Arabian Nights stories? One of them Disney made popular, and it's called Aladdin. It's the story of Jasmine and Prince Ali and the Sultan. And so I did a little bit of checking on this. I hadn't really ever studied this before. I'm sure in like high school literature somewhere along the lines, I learned about it in depth and have forgotten. But I looked into this again, and you know, the story of the Arabian Nights is quite a tale. It's one broad story that ties together all of these folklore stories of India, China, and the Mideast from about 500 BC up to about 1700 AD. So it's 2,000 years of Middle East and Asian history put into 1,001 stories. It's called 1,001 Arabian Nights. And what the story is, the broader story, and it isn't a historical account. Everyone understands that this is a contrived story. It isn't an actual account of events that happened. But there is a king in India who ruled India and China. And he was a ruthless king, very powerful. And he reigned during the time of the Persian Empire that we're studying in Esther, which is from Ethiopia, or Kush is what the Old Testament calls it, which is like modern day Libya, all the way through northern Africa, the Middle East, to India. Well, this ruler in the story of Arabian Nights ruled India and China, the other part of the world that wasn't this middle part. And this king was very ruthless. And it turns out that his wife and his brother had an affair, which greatly disturbed the king. And so he first executed his brother and then had his wife executed. And to console himself, he would woo and marry a virgin, and on the morning after their wedding day, he would have her executed. And he repeated this time and time and time again, as the story goes, until there were no women left except the daughter of his chief advisor. And the daughter of his chief advisor volunteered herself to be the last one to marry the king. And on the night of their marriage, she began to tell the king the first of 1,001 stories. And she told him the beginning of the story and left it at the big climax so that the king didn't know what was happening in the story. And so the next morning, he wakes up having dreams and memories of this story that his new wife had just shared with him. And the executioners came in to kill her, and he called them off. He said, "Don't kill her. I need to know the end of the story." And so she bought herself one day. And that night, she finished up the first story and said, "Do you want to hear another one?" "Yeah, that was great. Tell me some more stories." And she began to unfold some more intrigue and told another story. And just as it got to the climax, she fell asleep and didn't finish the tale. And so again, another day went by. And for 1,001 nights, she shared these stories to save her own life. And it worked. And this is how the legend goes. And one of those stories is the story of Aladdin. And every one of those stories has a hero and a villain who face off in a great mystery and intrigue and battles and wars and family conflict and everything that makes up a good story. And as you're going through all of these stories, every person watching is anticipating how the hero is going to beat the villain, right? This is why my wife hates sad movies. Movies and stories should not end sad. The hero needs to win, not die. Right? And so my wife isn't a big Shakespeare fan, so I don't have to worry about taking her to the Shakespeare Festival this summer, which many of you will probably do, because she won't enjoy it. Because we go into the story expecting the happy ending. And as we read the Bible and all of God's history, we see that same thing unfolding. And I believe that it's something that God put in us. And all throughout the Old Testament, it's as if you can see the letters on the page crying out for the hero to fix this mess. And so as this story unfolds, we are going to look at Esther and see how God's providence preserved his people and was a shadow of what was to come. So let's take a look at Esther chapter 2, verses 1 through 4, where we are going to learn about the great mystery of this story as all the characters are brought together, and we're going to see some palace intrigue. That's the first of your notes on the back of your bulletin, palace intrigue. Esther 2, verses 1 through 4. "After these things," which is what we talked about last week, and you can go online later this week and listen to that. "After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus," and last week I reminded you that this is his Hebrew name, his Greek name, we know him as King Xerxes, which is a familiar historical figure. This is his Hebrew name in the Bible. And so I will call him King Xerxes because it's much easier than King Ahasuerus. When the anger of King Xerxes had abated, he remembered Vashti, the wife that he disposed of in chapter 1, and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather together all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young women who pleases, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now, before we read 12 through 14, which is going to give a little bit more to this story of what this intrigue is, let me first just point out a couple of things here in these opening verses. First, it says that the king remembered Vashti, his queen. Now, rabbinical commentators in the time period between the Old Testament and the New Testament, so Jewish teachers in that time between the Old Testament being compiled and Jesus stepping onto the earth, they taught about the story of Esther and celebrated a feast called Purim, which is a celebration of Esther's victory later in the story. And in fact, it's a very intriguing story and a very intriguing festival that people actually boo and hiss when the villain's name is mentioned, and they cheer and applaud every time Esther's name is mentioned, which is like 55 times in the story as it's read out loud. And so it's a very animated retelling that happens every year at the Feast of Purim. Well, the rabbinical teachers taught that what was happening here is King Xerxes was lamenting what he had done in chapter 1. He remembered his fair queen. He had just come back from a defeat against the Greeks and trying to conquer them, and he was unable to do so, just like his father before him was unable to do so. And he was came back and was waiting, you know, anticipating to come back to his palace and celebrate, and or not celebrate, but be consoled by his queen. And he remembered, oh yeah, she's not queen anymore. I made that decree that she would be put away from me forever. And the law of the Medes and Persians could not be changed. So if he said away with her, he could not call her back because the law could not be changed. And so they say that this was a moment of regret for the king, that he really regretted what he had done. Now, the Bible isn't clear on this. We get that background from that teaching in the intertestamental period. So then the king's young men said, "Hey, we got an idea." Now, the book of Ecclesiastes says that there is nothing new under the sun. And today, this exact story is unfolding on ABC Weekly. They call it The Bachelor, where beautiful young virgins are brought together to win the affection, and whichever one is loved the most by the king, he will take her as his prize. So let's read verses 12 through 14 and see how this reality show of the Medes and Persians unfolded. "Now when the turn came for each young woman to go in to King Xerxes, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying." So you imagine these young women, probably 14 to 18 years old, they're brought in and they go through a 12-month training program to prepare themselves to enter the king's bedroom for one night. And what is it that happens during these 12 months? Well, we hear about it in verse 12. "For 6 months, they were anointed with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with spices and ointments for women. So they were made to smell nice and to learn to be beautiful. And they were also, when the young women, and they were probably also taught how to carry themselves in the presence of the king, what to say, what not to say, how to carry themselves like a princess or a queen. And then in verse 13, "When the young women went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. So for 12 months, she's in this group of women in the harem being trained in beauty and whatever she was being trained in, being anointed with fragrances and ointments and lotions and learning how to carry herself. And then whatever she wanted to take with her to pleasure the king on her one night with him, she could take it from the harem. Of all the tools and things that she was trained with, she was able to take that. Whatever clothing, whatever jewelry, whatever she wanted. And so they would take it in. And in the evening, verse 14, she would go in to the king. And in the morning, she would return to the second harem in the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. And so a transfer would happen during this night. She would be in the training harem. And when she went in to be with the king, she would leave no longer a virgin. And having slept with the king, she was now forever his, and no other man could have her. She was now considered part of the royal family, even if she never returned to the king again in her life. And so she would be transferred from the first harem to the second harem, to live now with all of the concubines, all the women who had been put into the service of the king for at least one night. She would not go back into the king's presence unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. So her only hope of ever returning to this king was to make such a lasting impression that he remembered her name. Now it is said in the rabbinical literature that two contests happened for this one moment in time. And we'll read about that later in chapter 2, and it may make sense. So, there is some debate about whether there was a second contest or not. And it is said that there were 300 women in each group. So this contest went on for 600 days at the most and 300 at the least, that the king was having one woman after the other each night. And as we talked about last week, and I just mention it again because some of you weren't here, this is what happens when you feast with the king of this world, is he denigrates men and he mistreats women. That's what the prince of the power of the air of this world does. And it's abusive, and it's not biblical, and it's not God's design for his people. And so we reject this idea, but you know, the Bible is raw. It tells us the real stuff of life. And as I pointed out last week, this kind of thing is still happening. There are men in America who are taking virgins for themselves, and they're finding a new one every night. And they're paying pimps and parents and employers and brothers and sisters and boyfriends to find them. And they will pay a lot of money to have a younger one, boy or girl. This is not something that just happened in 500 AD. This is happening today. And may the Lord have mercy on us for our sin. So what happens today in American culture over 12 episodes on ABC on Thursday nights took nearly 2 years to process. And perhaps the king was consoled, perhaps he wasn't, but you see the unfolding story. The Bible is setting up this guy as the bad guy. Now we're going to go back and read the part we skipped over, verses 5 through 11, where the heroes are introduced. Now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shemaiah, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So here in these first couple of verses of this next section, we meet Mordecai and Esther. Mordecai is Esther's older cousin. His uncle had a daughter named Hadassah. That is her Hebrew name, Hadassah. Hadassah means, Hadassah means myrtle in Hebrew. And a myrtle is a star-shaped flower. Her Persian name is Esther, which also means star, but not a flower, an actual star. And the Persians were very into astrology and reading of the stars, and they worshipped Zoroaster,
And so this is not uncommon for a person to be named after a heavenly body. And so Esther had a Hebrew name and a Persian name. And she was young, her cousin was old, and he adopted her. Now, we're not sure how old Mordecai was. It says here that he was the son of, you know, often the Bible, when it introduces a character, it puts them in the genealogy, because the people reading this story in the time period of it being written would know those people. Oh, yeah, I remember that family line. You know, like in my family, it's, oh, you're one of the Murphys. This happened at Kevin's dad's funeral on Friday. His sister came and said, how are you doing? You probably don't remember me. And we started to put the story together, and we realized that I was probably not even born when she was, during the time of the story that she thought that I might know her. And it is possible that maybe I was, but I actually think she was thinking of my older brother because of the story that she told me. He's 8 years older than me, and I'm the next child. So, you're one of the Murphy kids, right? Yeah, I'm one of, you're son of Norm? Yeah. Son of Ruth? Yes. So your sister's Rowena. That's right. Okay, now I know who you are. No, you just met me, right? And that's what the Bible does. We just are meeting Mordecai, but he's saying, oh, but he's the son of Jair, the son of Shemaiah, the son of Kish, who was a Benjamite, who returned with, who came to Babylon during the when Jerusalem was captured by Nebuchadnezzar. So it's putting Mordecai in a historical context of real people who can be confirmed in history to have existed and lived. The cities are real. The Bible's not fairy tale. It's historical documentation of what happened. Now, there's a little bit of confusion here as to who the Bible is talking about when it says he had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives. If this is referring to Mordecai himself, then it means that Mordecai would have been 115 years old at this moment in time. So it probably wasn't Mordecai. What we think this is describing is that Mordecai's great-grandfather, Kish, the Benjamite, he was the one who was captured 115 years earlier and came to live in Babylon. And then Mordecai is now three generations later and is living in Babylon. His uncle, one of the brothers of his father, Jair, died after having a daughter, Hadassah. And so Mordecai, seeing that this young woman didn't have a father or a mother, he adopted her as his own son, and this cousin raised his own cousin. And so this is the same kind of thing happens in America, doesn't it? I mean, I know people who are being raised by their aunt, or we had a family visit our church a couple of years ago, and the grandmother had adopted the grandson, the grandmother had adopted one of the grandsons, and the aunt had adopted the other grandson, so one of the grandsons was brother to his own aunt, and uncle to his brother. I mean, it was like, okay, yeah, this stuff happens, right? I mean, this is weird stuff, but it happens. And that the Bible is just raw and real about the stuff of life. And so here we have Mordecai, whose Persian name is named after Marduk, a Persian god, a son of Kish, who was a Benjamite. Now, if you think for a moment, and maybe you know or don't know, the line of Benjamin is the same line that King Saul came from. And if Mordecai is of the kingly line and part of the Benjamin family, then so is Esther, which means that she is royalty in the kingdom of the Jews. She is a daughter of the king, King Saul. And so this means that Esther is already a princess before she's introduced to the king. And it's kind of symbolic here that Esther's names are both given, her Hebrew and her Persian name. Because as we read the story, we're going to see that Esther really wrestles with both of those identities. Is she Hadassah, a daughter of God, a myrtle flower as a princess in the kingdom of the Jews? Or is she Esther, a Persian concubine put into the service of the king of Persia? Which is she? And who will she serve? The king of the Persian Empire or the king of heaven? And it's interesting because there are some
who have done some word study on the name Esther, who have found that this name Esther can also mean hidden away. Hidden away. And as you read the story of the book of Esther, God's name is never mentioned. He's hidden. I like to call this the God of the spaces. His name is not written in letters or sentences or words, but he is in the spaces of the story of Esther. And so if her name means hidden away, it is very symbolic of God in this story. And Esther herself kind of hides God away. She doesn't let her identity be known. So let's read, continue reading. I think we stopped at the end of verse 7. So in verse 8, let's read what Esther does. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered together in Susa, the citadel, in the custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in the custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. Now this word taken in the original language just means taken. There are some commentators who say it was forced. She didn't want to go. Mordecai didn't want to give her up, and they took her by force. But we don't know that. That's someone's conjecture. It could have just meant she was taken, and she could have went willingly, and they took her to this place once she was taken. We don't know for sure, but we do know that whatever the Persian king wants, he gets. And so if she had refused, he probably could have forced her. But we don't want to read too much into it because we just don't know. Verse 9, and the young women pleased him, though young woman, I keep saying women when it's singular, sorry. Try to follow me. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of the food and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. So the first thing that happens is Esther enters the harem, and the guy in charge, Haggai, is like, this one's special. I like this one. And so he quickly gets her to the front of the line where she gets to start her beautification first, and she gets cosmetics, and she is the first one at the table to be handed her food. And he not only gives her great food and cosmetics, he says, these 7 women who are part of the concubines, they're going to serve you. And you're going to get some experienced ladies to be your maidens to help you on this journey. And so immediately, Esther is found to have favor in the eyes of the chief eunuch. Now, if you read Daniel chapter 1, this story is familiar, where Daniel enters into the king of Nebuchadnezzar during Mordecai's great-grandfather's time in Babylon. Daniel was in the kingdom in Babylon. And Daniel actually died just before Xerxes' father, Darius, was ruler. Just before this guy. It is possible that Daniel, being 90 years old, was alive when Xerxes was born as a toddler. It is possible that Daniel and Xerxes lived a few years together in time. Although it's not, it could be the opposite, that they missed each other by a couple of years. So this sounds familiar. Daniel's put in charge, or brought into the kingdom and educated. He is made a eunuch, likely. Daniel was a eunuch. And he learned the languages of all the different nations, and he learned about the gods of this new ruler. And Daniel was trained up. And he found favor in the eyes of the guy in charge of him. And this man helped Daniel. And Daniel went to him and said, you know, our God forbids us eating meat offered to idols. And so I just want to eat vegetables and water. And he goes, oh, but then you're going to get weak and you're not going to be able to think and you're going to do poorly in school. And Daniel said, test me for 7 days. And at the end of 7 days, if I am any less than these others, then I'll eat the meat. And so the man agrees because of the favor of God. And Daniel is doing just fine. And so he lets him abstain from eating the meat offered to idols. However, Esther handled this differently. Let's read verse 10. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai, her father, cousin, had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was doing and what was happening to her. Now, something that we didn't mention when we were talking about Mordecai a minute ago is commentators early, that intertestamental time, they say that Mordecai was one of the officials in the king's palace, and that he was in charge of the gate. And one of his duties was to be at the gate and to let people in and out from the palace who were permitted and not permitted, and to monitor the gate, all the gates of the palace, which would include the first harem and the other harem. And so he would, on his duties, walking by, just happen to stop by where his cousin daughter was being held and check in on her. How was she doing? And as the story unfolds, you'll see that Mordecai keeps picking up information that he shouldn't really know about, but it was probably because he had good ears standing at the gate, and he would hear conversations happening, and he would use that information to guide Esther in her intrigue in the palace. And so Mordecai tells her, I know a lot about what's going on in the palace, Esther. We don't want it to be known that you're a Jew. So don't let the word get out. So that means she would have had to have eaten the meat and partook of the things that weren't allowed. The other thing is, before Mordecai and Esther were even born, the king had already said to Ezra, take people back to Jerusalem. And what, 50,000 people had returned to Jerusalem, but these two didn't. So they already weren't where they were supposed to be. They were rebelling against God. God had commanded them to go to Jerusalem, and they didn't. They stayed in Babylon. So Esther and Mordecai, even though they are kind of being portrayed as the heroes in this story, they're not doing everything right. They're not doing everything perfect. She hid her Jewishness. I don't know if that's the right way to say that. She partook of meat offered to idols. The book of Esther never says that she ever prayed, that she ever fasted, that she ever worshiped God. So she, although is appearing as the heroine in this story, she is keeping her faith at a distance. And you know, that's not unlike a lot of us. This story can be like us, where, you know, oh, yeah, I'm a Christian, but I just don't want everybody to know about that. And so, you know, when I'm with the guys, I'll just do what the guys do. And then it won't make a scene, and, you know, they'll accept me. And then maybe later that will come out. And that's exactly what Esther and Mordecai had told her to do. And even though she wasn't honest about who she was, God still led her and guided her. And that's what God does for us too. Now, what would have happened if she had been out with it? Oh, I'm a Jew. I can't eat this meat. What would have happened? Well, perhaps she had already won enough favor with Haggai, this chief eunuch, that it would have been just fine. Like Daniel, it was just fine. But in this case, she hid it, and that's what we have in the story. And either way, whether she had testified to who she really was or whether she kept it a secret, God can still accomplish his will. God will still accomplish his will. He did it with Daniel, and he did it with Esther. All right, this leads us to the last part of the story. The first part is the palace intrigue. The second part is the entrance of the hero. And the third part is the hero rising. So let's read in verses 15 through 18 how the hero rises. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter to go into the king, she asked for nothing. Remember, she could have anything she wanted from the harem, but she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. So she said to Haggai, what do you think I should take? And he said, this and this and this, and that's what she took. Now, Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Xerxes into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now, I wanted to wait until we got to this point to draw out what's going on. In chapter 1, verse 1, it says it was the 3rd year of his reign. Right here, it's telling us that by the time Esther comes around to having her turn during this possible 600-day television program, it was the 7th year, 10th month, almost 8 years into his reign. So if you just kind of figure out the math, from the 3rd year to the 8th year. So that means we're like 5 years later from when Vashti refused to go and present herself to his drunken buddies at the big party. So 5 years has gone by without a queen in the kingdom of the Persians. So what happened? What was going on during this 5 years? Well, history is actually pretty clear about this. because in the fourth year of King Xerxes' reign, he besieged the Greeks and attacked Athens. And the battle waged for almost 2 years. And some historians say that he took 5 million into battle against the Greeks. And he returned with 5,000 men. So this was a long, drawn-out battle. And so at the beginning of chapter 2, when it says, after these things, when the anger of King Xerxes had abated, he remembered Vashti. So this is the context of all of this. He comes back, he's defeated, lost all of his army, he's the greatest ruler the world has known up until this time, later to be taken over by the Greeks, and then ultimately by the Romans, who was the last world empire. And here he is, defeated, coming back home, wanting a queen and having none. And that's when this story happened. So now, that was in the fourth and fifth year of his reign, and then the sixth and seventh year is the beginning of this story, and Esther's turn isn't until the 10th month of the seventh year of his reign. And this is when the Jews celebrate the Feast of Purim, is in memory of this moment. And so she takes her turn, and she goes in with the king. And verse 17 says, the king loved Esther more than all the women. Now, we would wish and hope that this love meant that the king would change his ways. I found a woman to love, and she's beautiful, and she pleases me, and now I will abstain from all of my concubines and my harem, and this will be my one soulmate. No, that isn't what the Bible is saying. One of the women was chosen to be queen, but the king still had pleasure with all of them and anyone he wanted, and she could only enter his presence if he called her by name, even being queen. So the king loved Esther, and that is just the most generic word for love you can imagine. And she won the grace and favor in his sight more than all the other virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king gave a great feast. This guy and his feasts. History actually records that Xerxes was a big-time party animal. Every chance he could, he threw a party. And he was known for his drunkenness and his abuse of women, actually, outside of the Bible, even. The king gave a great feast for all his officials and his servants. It was called Esther's Feast. He also granted a remission of taxes to the provinces and gave gifts with royal generosity. So the king says to all of his empire, from Libya to India, 127 provinces, the biggest kingdom the world had ever seen to his day. He says, I am declaring a feast, and no one will pay taxes during this great holiday of the government. And all the people said, woohoo! You know, could you imagine Trump? In celebration of Melania's birthday, we will not pay taxes for the whole month of June. It's like, what? This is awesome. We would be celebrating. And so the people did. And not only did he say no taxes during this feast, but he also gave away gifts from the kingdom to the people. And the king gave his riches out because he wanted the whole kingdom to celebrate the new queen. And probably he wanted the kingdom to not worry so much about, 995,000 people who just died in the battle in Athens. And so he gave away all these gifts. So the story is laid out. Esther comes into the harem. She finds favor there. She goes before the king and is chosen to be queen. And the story makes us want to go, yay for Esther, right? A good story does that. And then after you think about it, you're like, wait a second, what am I celebrating? How is this good? She's hiding her nationality. She's now being put into the service of this pagan king. The Old Testament is clear. Jews are not supposed to marry Gentiles. So she should never be in this relationship. It's not a monogamous relationship like God would design. This woman is living in compromise. So on one hand, we're going, yay, Esther won the bachelor. And on the other hand, we're going, poor woman, what she put herself through and what was she thinking? And you know that's exactly what happens with our ABC television reality show. Is at the end of the show, we're going, yay, wait a second, why am I celebrating this? That girl just put herself through a terrible experience, and this relationship will probably not work out, you know, because of how it came to be. And that's exactly what we think as we look at this story. And so another feast ensues, and the big party animal, Xerxes, has a celebration. Now, As we come to the end of chapter 2, it's easy for us to spot who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. But in reality, what the Bible is teaching us is that there are no good guys. All of us are sinful bad guys. Even Esther and Mordecai in this story have faults. King David, the man after God's own heart, had an affair with one of his military officers' wives while he was away on battle, had tried to have him executed, and did everything he could to have him killed. He finally was killed, and then took her to be his wife in his harem. This man after God's own heart. And you know, Esther's story is our story. All of us are the bad guys. And what Esther is telling us and all the people of Jerusalem and all the people of the world is the good guy is coming who is going to set all of this right. The good guy is coming. He's not found in the words or the sentences or the paragraphs, but he's found in the spaces. And whether we're living in full submission to God, God, you're my Lord, I honor you with all of my heart, my soul, my mind, and my strength, the God of the spaces will still accomplish his will. Or whether we're like Esther, living with two identities, having one name at church on Sunday mornings or at Bible study on Wednesday night, but carrying a different name with us into the classroom or the break room of Monday, the God of the spaces will still accomplish his will. Or whether we are living in open rebellion, turning our back on God like Xerxes and the other villains in this story, the God of the spaces will still accomplish his will. The Bible teaches us when Jesus is asked how to pray, he says, pray like this, God's will be done on earth as it is in heaven. And God's will be done. God's will be done. Because Esther's story is our story, but our story is God's story. And Esther's story is God's story. How is Esther's story God's story? Well, Esther is a picture of the Messiah to come. And as the Jews hear this story, that's why they celebrate and cheer when her name is read. She saved us! And that is why the people cheer and celebrate on Sunday mornings when we sing, My Savior, My Savior lives, because Messiah came and he saved us. Like Esther, Jesus' identity was hidden in his early life and revealed at just the right time to save his people. Like Esther, Jesus grew up away from his home in heaven. Like Esther, Jesus was adopted by an earthly father, except his father was not named Mordecai. His name was Joseph. Like Esther, Jesus grew up poor and humble. But unlike Esther, he never lived in a palace, and his crown was made of thorns, not jewels. Like Esther, Jesus came from a family line of God's covenant people. But unlike Esther, he became the new covenant himself in the flesh. Like Esther, Jesus was raised in an evil world. But unlike Esther, he never compromised to survive it. Like Esther, Jesus stood up against sinful rulers to save his people from death. But unlike Esther, he gave himself over to take death in their place. God used Esther, this not perfect person. God used David. God used Paul, someone who murdered Christians. God used Brad, and God will use you to illuminate his son so that the light of the world may shine in the darkness. We can thank God for people like Esther or Hadassah, but we cannot count on them to forgive us of our sin. I invite you today to turn to Jesus, the real hero of the story, the God of the spaces.